Imagine, if you will, a podcast. A podcast journeying beyond that which is known to man. It exists in both fandom and discovery, in viewing and critiquing. My name is Matt Hurt. Welcome to Anthology. Hello, and welcome to Anthology, presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. If this is your first time listening, Anthology is a podcast exploring science fiction anthology storytelling during television's golden age, beginning with The Twilight Zone. Each podcast, I take two episodes of The Twilight Zone, give a summary of the plot, share notable cast and crew trivia, and then delve into my feelings on the episode as a first-time viewer of the show. You can find more of Anthology at anthologypod.com. And if you want to contact me, you can tweet me at ObsessiveViewer, send an email to matt@ObsessiveViewer.com, message me at facebook.com/anthologypod, or you can call and leave a voicemail at 317-762-6099. Today I'll be discussing episodes 9 and 10 of The Twilight Zone's first season. But first, I want to apologize. Give a couple of apologies. First of all, I know it's been a couple weeks since I've posted an episode of this podcast. Real life kind of got in the way. I've been looking for a new job, and between updating the resume and applying and interviewing and all that stuff, I've just been kind of busy, and it's kind of gotten in the way. So I apologize for the lack of an episode, and I'm looking forward to catching back up and getting back on schedule. And also, last episode, I made the... I mistook Judgment Night for a time travel episode because it had been a while since I'd seen the episode. So forgive me for that. And also, before I get started, thank you for all the awesome emails and tweets and Facebook posts and iTunes reviews. It's helped out a lot, and it's really great to know that people are listening to it and people are, for the most part, enjoying the show. So I'm definitely going to be getting some more content out to you guys. And keep the feedback coming and keep the conversation coming. I really enjoy it. And I'm trying to get – I have on my dry erase board, I have like a goal for saving money to get the Blu-ray set for The Twilight Zone. One of the listeners emailed me and recommended it. And it's – ever since then, I've just been really – really wanting to get that Blu-ray set for the complete series. So hopefully when that happens, I'll get more detail and more trivia out of it. But anyway, so this week I'm talking about episodes 9 and 10, as I said before, Perchance to Dream and Judgment Night. Both of these episodes focus on frantic men trying to stay alive in the face of certain but confusing death in the Twilight Zone. So without further ado, here we go.
12 o'clock noon. An ordinary scene, an ordinary city. Lunchtime for thousands of ordinary people. To most of them, this hour will be a rest, a pleasant break in the day's routine. To most, but not all. To Edward Hall, time is an enemy. And the hour to come is a matter of life and death.
All right, so first up we have Perchance to Dream. This episode aired on November 27th, 1959, and as always, I'm going to start out with a summary of the plot from The Twilight Zone Companion by Mark Zakri. Of course, this will be spoiler heavy, so make sure you watch the episode before you listen to this episode of the podcast. Hall, a man with a cardiac condition, has sought out the aid of Dr. Rathman, a psychiatrist. He explains that he's been dreaming in chapters as if in a movie serial. In his dream, Maya, a carnival dancer, lures him into a funhouse and onto a roller coaster with the express intention of scaring him to death. If he goes to sleep, he knows he'll return to the dream and will have a fatal heart attack. On the other hand, if he stays awake much longer, the strain will be too much for his heart. Realizing that Rathman can't help him, he starts to go, but stops when he realizes that the doctor's receptionist is a dead ringer for the girl in his dream. Terrified, he runs back into Rathman's office and jumps out the window to his death. The doctor calls his receptionist into his office, where Hall lies on the couch, his eyes closed. Rathman tells the receptionist that Hall came in, lay down, immediately fell asleep, and then a few minutes later let out a scream and died. Starring in this episode is Richard Conte as Edward Hall. He was an actor known for his normal everyman appearance. He has kind of a Justin Long thing going for him, at least I found. Often worked in noir movies, but his most notable role was as Don Barzini in The Godfather. I think he actually auditioned for the role of Vito Corleone, but they decided to go with Marlon Brando. The Godfather actually was released 3 years before Richard Conte's death from a heart attack. He also appeared in the original Ocean's 11 and Call Northside 777 opposite Jimmy Stewart. That's a movie that I'd actually really, really like to see. It's on my list of extracurricular viewing for this podcast, I guess. This is Richard Conte's only appearance on The Twilight Zone. Playing the psychiatrist in this episode, Dr. Rathman, is John Larch. This is his first of three Twilight Zone episodes. He's a very notable character actor who appeared in Play Misty For Me, Dirty Harry, the Amityville Horror, and many other movies. Before he became an actor, he was a professional baseball player. And since this is his first of three Twilight Zone episodes, I'll probably go into more detail about him in a later episode of Anthology. But I think that's some interesting bit of trivia for him. And rounding out the cast in this episode is Suzanne Lloyd, who played Maya and Miss Thomas, the receptionist. I'll just go ahead and say it. She's jaw-droppingly gorgeous. Like, seriously. This episode was just really... She was very mesmerized in this episode. Her last acting job was in 1974. I'm not sure if she's still alive or working or anything like that. IMDb is kind of vague on that, and it doesn't list a birth date on it. This was her only episode of The Twilight Zone, and she appeared in one episode of Alcoa Presents One Step Beyond, which was a science fiction anthology show. If I'm not mistaken, I believe One Step Beyond was focused on taking real-world stories and going supernatural with them or something like that. I think there are some episodes available on Hulu. I may eventually cover that show down the road. I mean, we're talking years from now after I finish Twilight Zone and the Outer Limits and probably a couple other shows that are that I'll probably cover after that. But I mean, who knows? Maybe one day I'll be covering One Step Beyond and I will be seeing Suzanne Lloyd again. But yeah, this was her only episode of The Twilight Zone, so I would say that she rocked it pretty well. This was the introduction of Charles Beaumont as a writer for The Twilight Zone. He was the single, like, most important creative force in the early years of the show, aside from Rod Serling himself. This episode was adapted from Charles Beaumont's original story that was first published in Playboy in November 1958. I'm not sure what kind of what differences there are between the two between the story and the adaptation. I didn't get a chance to read the actual story. I think that it was published in a couple of collections that he wrote, but I don't think they're in print anymore. So I'm not sure how easy it would be to find this particular story. But we live in the age of the internet and everything, so I'm sure it's out there somewhere. A little bit of background on Charles Beaumont. This is kind of, I guess this is kind of bleak and really just tragic. His early death, like, he died early. It was pretty shocking. He suffered from a degenerative aging disease, which gave him the appearance of an old man, very, very young. He was 38 years old at the time, and it was speculated that he was suffering from simultaneously suffering from Pick's disease and early onset Alzheimer's. And it's just sad. He was a very prolific writer, and he was very successful. But you know, when these medical issues cropped up, it found it virtually impossible for him to work in the last 3 years of his life. It's sad to hear that. It's really tragic that someone could, you know, die so young and be in such a position to do such good work for an important television show. It's tragic. It's sad. As for the themes of this episode of Perchance to Dream, I couldn't really pick up on much in terms of, you know, what it could represent or anything like that. I mean, maybe mental health. Maybe there's a theme of mental health running through this where one person is convinced of a reality that maybe isn't real or their mind is constructing a life-ending scenario, and there's no help around for them. I don't know. Maybe I'm grasping at straws with that, but I don't know. It's an entertaining episode, but it's hard to find something as clear-cut a theme for me as, like, say, the Lonely or Time Enough at Last. Some other background on Charles Beaumont, though. This is taken from his IMDb page. His mentally unstable mother at one time dressed him in girls' clothes and killed one of his pets as a form of punishment. This later inspired his short story, Mrs. Gentlebell. He was eventually farmed out to the care of five widowed aunts who operated a boarding house and regaled young Charles with nightly tales detailing the peculiar demise of each of their husbands. Somehow, perhaps unsurprisingly, young Charles developed his macabre sense of humor. So, and that kind of dives in, or that kind of leads into this episode being kind of having more of a horror center to it. And I'll get more into that here in a second, but I will say that I kind of hope that future episodes written by Mr. Beaumont are horror-leaning as well. That's my hope, at least. I have no context. As I've said at the top of this episode and at the top of the podcast, this is my first time watching the show, so I don't know. Director for this episode is Robert Flory. This is his first of three Twilight Zone episodes. He was born in Paris, France in 1900, and he directed a ton of B-movies and was known to bring them in on or under budget, despite frequently running over schedule, which sounds like a really incredible talent. he died in 1979 from cancer, and since this is his first of three episodes, I'll talk more about his work in later episodes of Anthology. But for now, I'm going to go on to my feelings as a viewer toward Perchance to Dream. And, you know, it's funny. When I started this episode, I didn't know that it wasn't written by Serling. This is the ninth episode of the series, and up until now, every episode's been written by Rod Serling, and I know that he wrote the majority of episodes. So I just kind of assumed that it was going to be written by Serling again. And it wasn't until the end credits when I saw Charles Beaumont's name that I kind of realized, like, why I wasn't getting attached to this episode as much as previous ones. And I don't know. I just found Perchance to Dream kind of really hard to get into as an episode. And I think that part of that is that maybe subconsciously I kind of noticed that the style of writing, the narrative wasn't the same as the eight previous episodes. And I think that kind of had a jarring experience in my mind, because I went back and rewatched it again after I compiled my notes and everything, and it got better, but I still felt like I felt like this episode spent a little too much time explaining the plot. I mean, Hall goes into Rathman's office, and then he's just divulging all of this exposition toward the psychiatrist, which is fine and it's entertaining. But I don't know. It's just so deeply steeped in ambiguity that it's a little bit off-putting for me. Like, for instance, his monologue about the boat painting, it was somewhat frustrating to me. It established some sort of mystical power that is kind of written off as overactive imagination, but I don't think there's really any follow-through on that. I mean, you know, he goes through this whole monologue where he explains that he, even as a kid, he could see things move in paintings and things like that. And then once he developed his rheumatic heart disease, it just made it more likely that it could exacerbate his condition. But I don't know. It kind of seemed like there was such an effort, or there's such an emphasis on the fact that, like, he can from a young age, he could see things move on paintings and stuff. I thought that when I hear that, at least the way that it's described, I kind of think like, oh, he might have some kind of weird special power or something like that. But there wasn't anything that really followed through on that line of thinking. I did really enjoy just the central concept of the episode, really about dreams and how he dreams in episodes, and the dream world is going to kill him. I really enjoy that kind of aspect of the story, and it's kind of funny because I can relate to the main character talking about dreaming in episodes, because one of my most memorable dream experiences, I guess, happened when I was in, I think, junior high. Well, for about a week straight, I dreamt every night that I was being chased by Michael Myers, and I was being chased by him in my mom's, in the building my mom worked at the time, which ended up being the building that I worked in and currently work in. And it was interesting. And I'm talking about my dreams on a podcast, so I apologize for that. but yeah, it's just, I can relate to that. And I've always found the dream world or dreaming a fascinating landscape for storytelling. I'm recording this a couple weeks after Wes Craven died. And of course, one of the big things he leaves behind in his legacy is you know, creating Nightmare on Elm Street. And that, while that movie franchise, I never really connected to that much. At a concept level, A Nightmare on Elm Street is one of the most interesting movie franchises of all time, because it strikes such a chord with audiences, because it dives into the dream world. It makes it's the victims of Freddy Krueger are killed while they're dreaming, which is the most vulnerable that we are, is when we're dreaming. And I feel like this episode of The Twilight Zone really tapped into that. If nothing else, I mean, I was a little put off by the pacing and everything, but I mean, this episode really plays with the concept of the dream world being, you know, our undoing, and where we can't control what we dream. And it's a terrifying thought for anyone who buys into it, really. And it's kind of a, I don't know, like I said, when we sleep, we're at our most vulnerable, and that can bring out a lot of horrific thoughts and horrific scenarios. And this is by far the most horror-leaning episode of The Twilight Zone that I've seen so far. And I really enjoyed that aspect of it. The dream sequences themselves are really spectacular and eerie. They're disorienting. They were disorienting, and they utilized tension really well. The amusement park and carnival, whatever you want to call it, is really creepy. And the seeing the sights and sounds and being bombarded with that is so unnerving to me. And especially because Edward Hall is really the only patron of the amusement park. And I mean, obviously there are probably, you know, there are some budget reasons and filming reasons for that, because I mean, why hire extras for a dream sequence and all that? But I felt like that really tapped into the eeriness of it, is that he's really the only one in this amusement park. And that's, I don't know, it was chilling to me, and it really amplified the dreamscape aspect of it. But what I didn't, and so all that's all well and good. This episode is aesthetically pleasing. It has a very unique concept that drives itself into fear in a very real way and relatable way. But at the end of the day, I'm just left wondering, why is she trying to kill him? Why is Maya trying to kill Edward Hall? And I just felt like the episode itself was too ambiguous. Because you have, like, we've had characters die on screen at the end of episodes. We've had, like, Escape Clause. He died because, you know, he made a deal with the devil, and he exercised his escape clause for it and stuff like that. Same with One for the Angels with Lou Bookman. He had a deal with death and all that. So we know why characters have died, but this episode just kind of was like, I don't know, it wasn't fulfilling to me. Like, at the end of the episode, Hall sees the receptionist and then jumps out the window, and then it's revealed that the whole episode was in his dream when he lay down on the futon in the psychiatrist's office. But I don't know. But, like, at the end of it, we see the receptionist come in, and she's still Suzanne Lloyd. And she and Rathman have a conversation, and then the episode ends on Serling's narration. I think it would have probably worked better had the receptionist been Maya, and then when the doctor brought her in the real world after Hall had died, if it was a different actress, then it would, I don't know, I still probably would have had problems with the ambiguity of it, but I think it would have worked better as a distinction between the real world and the dream world, because Maya throughout the episode was trying to kill Hall in her dream, in his dream. And then he couldn't sleep or he stayed up for 80 some hours. But when he walks into the office, he looks at the receptionist before he even goes in, and like, he looks long and hard at her and doesn't recognize her as Maya. So I feel like it would have been an overall better ending if it was a different actress when she came in to talk to Rathman in the real world, because that would have kind of put a different, a more unique spin on the dreams that he was having, because it would just show that for whatever reason, Maya constructed a new dream for him, in order to convince him to die, I guess. I don't know. I'm grasping at straws here. Overall, the episode was okay. It was well shot and really engaging on the story at the basic level of the story, I guess. And I just thought it was just okay, though. I had some pretty big issues with it and thought that it was just okay. It's not going to be one of the ones that I would call my favorite, I don't think, from this season, even. Definitely not from the show as a whole. I had some issues with it, and I hope that Charles Beaumont's future episodes are better for me. I will say that I did, again, just to reiterate, I did really, really enjoy the kind of horror leaning aspects of this episode. So hopefully I'll get to see more of that in future episodes of The Twilight Zone.
They say a dream takes only a second or so. And yet in that second, a man can live a lifetime. He can suffer and die, and who's to say which is the greater reality? The one we know or the one in dreams? Between heaven, the sky, the earth, in The Twilight Zone.
And of course, before we move on to the next episode, here's a highlight from a recent episode of The Obsessive Viewer, a weekly movie and TV podcast that I host with my friends Mike and Tiny.
How does the memory of Age of Ultron hold up to you guys?
Well, I saw it twice.
How'd that go? I sense a little,
I loved the spectacle of it both times. Both times I left the theater saying, oh, that was awesome. And I maybe even liked it better than the first. But when I'm looking at the list, it's not a movie of the year for me. It's not it'll end up in the top 10, but I don't know. I'm just like currently not floored by it. I also have to poop a little bit, so I'm not sure if that's...
You can find The Obsessive Viewer on iTunes, Stitcher, and at obsessiveviewer.com.
Well, the year is 1942, and this particular ship has lost its convoy. It travels alone like an aged, blind thing groping through the unfriendly dark, stalked by unseen periscopes of steel killers. Yes, the Queen of Glasgow is a frightened ship, and she carries with her a premonition of death.
Next up is Judgment Night. This episode aired December 4th, 1959. And here's the summary from The Twilight Zone Companion, written by Mark Sickery, which I highly recommend. Again, on board the Glasgow is a German named Carl Lancer, with no memory of how he got there, yet with the feeling that he's met all of the passengers somewhere before. Things are made even more mysterious by Lancer's certainty that an enemy sub is stalking the ship, and by his premonition that something is going to happen at 1:15 a.m. His fear proves correct. At 1:15, a U-boat surfaces. Peering through binoculars, Lancer sees that its captain is himself. The U-boat sinks the helpless freighter, then crew members machine gun the survivors. Lancer sinks beneath the waters. Later, on board the sub, a lieutenant suggests they might all face damnation for their action. Capitan Lancer discounts this theory, not realizing that he is, in fact, doomed to relive the sinking of that ship for eternity. Starring in this episode as Carl Lancer is, and I hope I'm not butchering this pronunciation, but Nehemiah Persoff. He was born in 1919 in Jerusalem. He was Jewish, and which made him playing a Nazi officer in this episode. Interesting. He was best known for roles in Some Like It Hot, Twins, The Last Temptation of Christ, and he also voiced Papa in An American Tale and its sequels. He also played Johnny Torrio in 1959's Al Capone, which was also featured Martin Balsam, who appeared in 16mm Shrine. He also had a lot of TV credits, mostly kind of one-off appearances. He was in an episode of Boris Karloff's anthology show Thriller. He also appeared in The Time Tunnel, Gilligan's Island, Mission Impossible, Mod Squad, Columbo, and a bunch of other stuff. According to his IMDb page, when declining health and high blood pressure forced him to slow down, Persoff took up painting in 1985, studying sketching in Los Angeles. Specializing in watercolor, he has created around 100 works of art, many of which have been exhibited up and down the coast of California. So that's interesting. That's nice to know. That's a nice thing to know that that he found something to be passionate about after he was unable to act anymore, I guess. This is the only episode of The Twilight Zone that he appears in, and I'll get into it in a bit, but his performance in this episode is just haunting. It's really, really great stuff, and it's a shame that this is his only episode of The Twilight Zone, but, I mean, what an episode. He gave a really great performance in it. Writer for this episode is, again, Rod Serling. And given the subject matter of this episode, I have to wonder if it was a way for Serling to kind of work through some of the atrocities that he saw in the war. There's a very overt kind of theme of being punished for things that you do in war. And it makes a powerful statement about, you know, damnation and you know, being punished for eternity. Director for this episode is John Brom. This is his second of 12 episodes. He directed more episodes of The Twilight Zone than any other director did. And I really loved the direction in this movie or in this episode. It was the shots of the ship. Obviously the exterior shots of the ship must be stock footage. The names on the ship are actually different, but the shots on the sets just matched the murky atmosphere of the establishing shots so well that it's nearly seamless. There was such a high production value with this episode, and I think John Brom really did a really great job bringing it to life and bringing this episode to life. So as for my feelings as a viewer on this episode, I really, really liked it. I mistakenly referred to it as a time travel episode last episode of Anthology, but it's not. He wakes up or he becomes aware that he's on the ship, and it's kind of an amnesia story, and then it turns into a story about him being haunted for eternity every night aboard the ship that he just destroyed. And it's really, really powerful stuff. And the production value, like I mentioned when I talked about John Brom, it's really, really spectacular. The sets that they used were from The Wreck of the Mary Dear, which was a movie that starred Charlton Heston and Gary Cooper, I think, that had actually just finished filming at the time of this episode. So, you know, there was some – they had the sets. There's an effect, and I don't know – I don't know if this is, like, standard for, you know, ships or anything like that of the time, or if this is a – or if this was a an effect that was utilized for the production itself and for, you know, the atmosphere of the episode. But when Carl Lanzer goes into the I guess, dining room area – every time the door opens, the lights go out, and it gives kind of a, real like theatrical feel. Like it feels like it's a stage play, and that this kind of effect is something that you would see in theater. And I thought that really, really helped sell the, it really helped demonstrate the power of this kind of single character focused narrative. Like he's. Like Carl Lanzer is the star of the show. Like he's the star of the episode. It's his performance that really brings home the message and the horror of the episode, really. And I think that having like little touches like that, like the lights going out when the door opens, if for whatever reason, I think that really helps increase the oddness of the episode and the kind of confused and strange feelings that Carl has throughout the episode. Another point to mention is I really love the music in this episode. This is an episode that kind of fires on all cylinders. Like everything is going on at once, everything is working well all at once, and there's not really a weak link in it. And the standout of the episode is the performance. Like I said, I mean, Persoff's performance is just incredible and incredibly haunting also. It's like you can tell that there's something in it. There's something to him that the viewer doesn't know yet, and he certainly doesn't know. But it gives this tense feeling as you watch it as he slowly discovers what is going to happen and what his fate is, once the U-boat appears. But before that, the actual scene where he discovers that he is a captain of a U-boat, it really ramps up the surrealistic tone of the story, like the kind of drama of the story, and that he's as confused as we are is. Just like that, that's such a nice twist at the end, at the middle point of the episode. It kind of feels like a kind of twist that you would almost, I don't know if it would really fit at the end of an episode, but it's like that level of twist, like, oh, he was a Nazi the whole time. Like that kind of thing could really carry a bit of weight to the end of an episode. But here it's right in the middle, and it ushers in our really incredible final act. For this episode, I mean, when he goes crazy and starts screaming that there's a U-boat after the clock hits 1:15, but he notices that everyone's gone, and there's that really haunting, again, that really haunting scene or that really haunting shot. And I say again because this is another time where the Twilight Zone utilizes mirrors. I believe it was a mirror. It may have just been a window now that I think about it, but any type of glass really, when he sees kind of like a portrait of the passengers and then they disappear. It's so gripping and so haunting. It was just, I don't know. It really stuck with me. And then again, the incredible production value once the fire and destruction happens, it was amazing to me that television could really show this type of violence really on screen at that time back in 1959, because like there's a scene where one of the passengers she's not engulfed in flames, but I mean, you know, she's surrounded by flames and then the camera cuts away from it, so you know your mind can kind of, you know, fill in the blanks there. But it's just a very kind of traumatic imagery in this episode, and it seamlessly incorporated authentic U-boat crew footage for those scenes, actually. And I don't know, like that really, I think that if they would have skimped on that, on that aspect of it, then the episode wouldn't have worked as well as it did for me. And I really appreciated that. And I thought that it was really terrific how they did that. And especially calling back with the little girl's little doll floating in the water. That's just like that type of imagery is kind of a cliche at this point. Like it's kind of a cliche now to say like, oh, you know, a callback, a visual callback such as that to show the tragedy of a young girl dying. I feel like I've seen it before in many other things, but seeing it in this episode in this context is really, really worked for me. Finally, at the end of the episode, when Lancer is back on the U-boat, he's not aware of, I think that according to Mark Sicree's summary of the episode, he doesn't seem like he, it almost feels like a flashback, like he's not aware of it. I think it takes place in the same kind of universe, I guess. It's an interesting, it's kind of interesting and a little confusing because, I mean, Lancer is on the ship and then he sees himself as the captain of the U-boat, and then by the end of the episode, you're led to believe, like, you know, he's going to repeat, or you're told, really, that he's going to be repeating that same scenario over and over for all eternity every night. And that just makes you, that boggles the mind a little bit. But yeah, so in this context, when he's talking to Mueller, he's unaware of, you know, his impending damnation. And I think that Mueller's description of their damnation is maybe what sparks this for Lancer and ushers in, you know, night after night of this hell. But I think that it's interesting to see. It's an interesting concept, and it's to hear Mueller describing their damnation with such an awful, awful German accent. Like he barely even. I think the actor doesn't really seem to be capable of a German accent, and it kind of jumps in and out of it. But nevertheless, that the button that it puts on this episode as a whole by describing the damnation and you know, hell that these men are going to be faced with is just really powerful. And then the final pin is Serling's closing narration. So this episode was really good. I really enjoyed it, and I know I'm a little all over the place here, but I really did enjoy this episode, and I thought the production value alone is just impeccable. It's really amazing. Yeah, there's not really much to criticize about except for, you know, the accent. But, a very solid episode. We'll see how it stacks up at the end of this season of The Twilight Zone, really, in terms of my favorite episodes. But overall, I'd say that I really enjoyed it.
The SS Queen of Glasgow heading for New York, and the time is 1942. For one man, it is always 1942.
Light in the salon! Let's black out down there.
And this man will ride the ghost of that ship every night for eternity. This is what is meant by paying the fiddler. This is the comeuppance awaiting every man when the ledger of his life is opened and examined. The tally made, and then the reward or the penalty paid. And in the case of Karl Lancer, former Kapitan Leutnant, Navy of the Third Reich, this is the penalty. This is the justice meted out. This is judgment night. In the Twilight Zone.
I will say, as a quick bit of trivia before we close out this episode, this episode was the only time that the Twilight Zone was censored. And this is a fun bit of trivia that when the passengers are all in the ship and they're drinking coffee, it was originally going to be that they were going to order tea since, you know, it's a British ship and British people drink tea. But it was changed to coffee because the sponsor for this episode was General Foods, who were sponsoring the episode with commercials for Senka coffee. And they felt that tea was a competitor for coffee. And they got them to change it. But this is the only episode to have a bit of censorship like that. So I know that was a big a big, big, big issue for Rod Serling going in. And it's one of the reasons why he started doing The Twilight Zone was because he was getting censored in all of his other work, really. And he felt that diving into science fiction would give him the ability not to be censored. And, yeah, it shows because this is the only episode that was censored, according to The Twilight Zone Companion. All right, so that should just about do it for this episode of Anthology. I will have a new episode up for you soon. I don't know when. I'm kind of busy, but I'm trying to keep to a schedule, and I will be hopefully, if I can, maybe doing two a week soon to get back on my schedule. But we'll see. But once again, thank you for listening, and keep, you know, giving me iTunes reviews, emails, Facebook comments, all that stuff, tweets, all that stuff. I'm really enjoying it. I'm really digging hearing back from you guys. And if you want to, let me know what you think about the next episodes I'm going to be reviewing. Next time on Anthology, I'll be covering episodes 11 and 12 of Twilight Zone's first season. Those episodes are And When the Sky Was Opened and What You Need. So go ahead and send me your emails, tweets, all that stuff with your thoughts on those episodes, and I'll include it in the episode of Anthology. For now, thanks again for listening, and I'll try to get back on a normal schedule. Until next time, have a good one. Thanks for listening. Thank you for listening to Anthology, presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. You can find past episodes of the show at AnthologyPod.com, and please subscribe on iTunes and leave a rating and review. It helps the show out more than you might think. Of course, I crave feedback or conversation of any kind from the audience, so please email your thoughts and feelings about the show to Matt@ObsessiveViewer.com. Or you can tweet me @ObsessiveViewer and make sure you like the Facebook page at facebook.com/anthologypod. Of course, you can also leave me a voicemail at 317-762-6099 for a chance to have it played on the show. If you like what you've heard here, I urge you to check out The Obsessive Viewer, a weekly movie and TV podcast I host with my friends Tiny and Mike. Also check out the Obsessive Viewer blog at ObsessiveViewer.com, where I write movie reviews, TV reviews, and the occasional editorial about the business of entertainment. You can find all of that at ObsessiveViewer.com. If you want even more obsessive content in your life, subscribe to the Obsessive Viewer subreddit at r/ObsessiveViewer. And check out ObsessiveBookNerd.com for book reviews, author spotlights, and a general celebration of reading. Finally, if you're philosophically curious, check out my friend Tiny's side project podcast, The Secular Perspective, which explores the concepts of faith, religion, and existence from the perspective of secular hosts. You can find that at thesecularperspective.com. Once again, thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.
Join the Obsessive Viewer podcast on October 16th, 2015 at the Irving Theater in Indianapolis for The Obsessive Viewer Presents Shocktober in Irvington Part 2. It's a one-night event screening of short horror films from local artists JP Leck and Snapshot Productions. There will be giveaways, raffles, interviews with the filmmakers, and so much more. All proceeds will go directly to the Irvington Historical Society. Go to shocktoberinirvington.com for more details, and prepare to be shocked.
The drive to go further and reach higher. The same thing that inspires you, inspires us. At Strayer University, we're always searching for new ways to make education more affordable. That's why we offer access to up to 10 no-cost gen ed courses to help you save time and money so you can keep striving. Visit strayer.edu to learn more. No-cost gen eds provided by Strayer University affiliates Sophia Learning. Eligibility rules apply. Connect with us for details. Strayer University is certified to operate in Virginia by CHEV.